Casey.
It would have been a good thing to say, Paul.
All right, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Saturday, July 1st, 2017. I'm going to open a work session for introduction of committee measures.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have LC-4555. It is the sign and die resolution.
Madam Chair, I move LC-4555 be introduced as a committee measure.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved LC-4555 be introduced as a committee measure. I will say, colleagues, that support of introducing a committee measure does not signify support for the underlying bill. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. I will close the work session. I will open a work session on public hearing on HCR 40.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 40 is the measure we introduced last week. It sets the timelines and bill limitation requests for the 2018 legislative session. It is a public hearing. We do have nobody here to testify for that today.
Do you want to testify on HCR 40?
Read the bill, what is about, Ms. Seiler, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 40 sets the bill limitations for legislative committees, for members of the judicial branch and the governor to be introduced for the 2018 legislative session. It also sets up the timelines for requesting those measures and filing those measures with the appropriate chamber prior to the start of the 2018 legislative session.
Yes, I would testify.
Come on down. Please state your name for the record, and please keep your testimony to the bill at hand.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Bill at hand right now. I feel like.
Can you please say
my
your name?
My name is Ronnie Wayne Daniels.
Thank you.
Of Polk County.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and all the other people that's here today. I believe at this current time, I would suggest that you would table this motion until the next available time. Doing that, there's other priority issues that is at hand, fiscally and accountability, that we haven't tackled yet. I believe also that the rest of the people that may want to testify on this period, being that we're on one-hour notices on hearings and everything else, is not getting the fair assessment and accountability to this action. So on these bases, Madam Chairman and various people of this committee, I ask you that you table this motion till the next regular legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. That I will close the public hearing. And we're gonna we're not moving that one today, colleagues. So with that, I will open a work session on SB 229A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 229A, which originally heard on June 13th, the underlying measure, Madam Chair, members of the committee, makes a number of technical statutory changes to campaign finance election laws. You do have three amendments before you today. You have the A8. The A8s, Madam Chairman, of the committee require candidate voters' pamphlet statement to include signature attesting that the statement is accurate and that knowingly providing false information is a Class C felony. You have the A9s, which charges the Citizens Initiative Review Commission with responsibility of drafting, amending, and certifying ballot titles for state initiative petitions, legislative referrals, and referendums. And then you have the A11s. It sets January 23rd of 2018 as date for statewide special election for any act passed by the 79th Legislative Assembly and referred to voters by referendum petition. It establishes a joint legislative committee comprised of three senators and three representatives to prepare a ballot title and explanatory statement to be included in a voter's pamphlet. It provides for judicial review by the Oregon Supreme Court of ballot title and statement. It stipulates that ballot title modified by Attorney General as a result of judicial review is not subject to further review. It provides Secretary of State with authority to adopt rules necessary to conduct election, including deadlines for submission of information for voters' pamphlet. The measure appropriates general fund dollars to the emergency board to be allocated for the Secretary of State. If a statewide special election is held, there is an emergency clause on the amendment. Madam Chair, members of the committee, because there is a general fund appropriation in this measure, it will need to go to Ways and Means today if you should adopt the A11 amendment and choose to move it. And we do have the paperwork to move with the A11s, Madam Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Hi, welcome. Well, thank you, Representative Williams, Chair Williams, and members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. Well, I'd actually hope to have two other of our colleagues here today with us, but for obvious reasons, they've gone home. And Representative Hayden, who wanted to be here as well today, was excused for the day from business. So I actually want to start just by reading his testimony into the record. He sent this to me and asked me to do so.
Well, and Representative Parrish, I just want to apologize for everyone who was here yesterday. I had a medical emergency and was in the hospital, and that's why the committee didn't go forward. So I want to make sure that's on the record so people know that that's what happened.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We're glad to see you're better. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the time and opportunity to testify. Again, this is from Cedric Hayden, State Representative, House District 7. He says he's here to oppose the dash 10s. I'm just going to assume he's going to oppose the dash 11s, but I want to make that for him, to House Bill 229. The amendment will change the relationship between voters and their legislature. Legislators are elected by the voter to uphold their rights, not circumvent the current law they were elected to uphold. The dash 10 will do just that by changing the referendum process. Yesterday, a press release, it was 2 days ago, a press release was put out, attempted to explain the rationale for the dash 10 based on House Bill 2391 and its alternative HB 3467. This explanation defies logic because House Bill 2391 had not yet been signed into law and House Bill 3467 is still in the Revenue Committee. The dash 10 would apply to all legislation, not just one potential bill. The press release does, however, make HB 2391 and HB 3467 germane to this testimony. When HB 2391 was carried to the floor by Representative Rayfield, supported by HB 2391, which taxes health care on college students, nonprofits, small business, and others. In his closing, he went on to say that HB 3467 funding did not add up. Did he read the bill? Did the author of the press release read HB 3467? I have provided an OLIS funding calculations in HB 3467. Go ahead and check my math. Better yet, have a hearing on it. As you can see, HB 3467 provides full funding on Medicaid in the first year and in the second year of the biennium. However, it does require funding reconciliation after the first year. This reconciliation would be based on a Secretary of State audit and eligibility redetermination. It would also allow for the recoupment of funds of up to $85 million if enrollment reduction forecast by the Oregon Health Authority are less than actual enrollment reductions. He believes Oregonians have the basic right to affordable health care and the taxation on health care premiums should be off limits. His urges to the committee is to oppose any amendments, the governor to veto HB 2391 and request hearings on HB 3467. This approach would resolve Medicaid stability concerns, make health care more affordable to ratepayers, retain voters' right to a reasonable check and balance on legislation while keeping him from joining the referendum petition on HB 2391 if signed into law. Thank you for your time, Senator Caden, House District 7. You wanted me to get that on the record, so there you have it.
Thank you very much.
I'm actually here to talk about the amendments. The underlying bill is a cleanup bill that was brought to you by former Secretary of State Gene Atkins. It was passed unanimously out of the Senate off the floor with no partisan votes against it. And amendments have come at last moment that I believe are designed to circumvent the normal election process. And so I want to just go through what I believe. I've not seen the dash 11, so forgive me. I think the only thing they do is put the funding mechanism back in because that was not in the A10. So I am going to sort of work off of the A10s and just talk about the issues. And forgive me if they don't 100% line up, but literally with everything else going on in this short of notice, I have not had a chance to read the A11s. So I'll stick to the A10s and hopefully they're germane to the 11s. In the A10, section 58.7, modified title, not subject to review. Well, actually, first let me back up. A January 23rd election. If you know anything about the elections calendar, you would know what's happening right then is that we've got public employees who in 36 counties who would be out on vacation with their families. I talked to one of my county clerks yesterday if we ran a January election. And that the timeline for the calendar for them, if they ran a January election, would mean that by their workforce policies, all of their folks would be required to not take vacations at Christmas. So they have a policy that says if there is an election on, we work. So what's happening before a January 23rd election? They're printing ballots. They're printing voters' pamphlets. They're hiring temporary workers, which comes with a cost to the county. And so for 36 counties, if we pass this bill, you will have counties that have their folks not have a Christmas vacation. I think that's a problem, given that, people like to take the holidays off, and Christmas generically being for all of those holidays that fall in the winter season. So January 23rd, special election. In our state's history, in 115 years of the referendum and referral process, it's only happened five times to have a January election. Two of them were to replace congressional, former Congressman David Wu and somebody way back when, as a Senate candidate. And three of them for tax-raising purposes. Only one of them, most recently, the Measure 6667, was actually successful. The other two January special elections where there was taxation both failed. So the normal process is, going to Section 58.7 of the Dash 10 Amendments, the modified title not subject to judicial review is an actual process. Actually, I'm on the wrong part of my notes. I'm sorry. Start with 55. Section 55, number 3, says the words limited described in ORS 250.0352 do not apply to the ballot title prepared by the Legislative Joint Assembly under this subsection. Currently, everybody who petitions their government is entitled to a 15-word title, 25-word yes or no statement, and 125-word summary. We are saying in this measure that somehow a bill that comes forward from the people, the legislature gets to go ahead and have the opportunity to write a book report, essentially. And a partisan committee of the legislature at that gets to write a book report on what they think the people's intent is. I think that's unfair. I think it could also have limiting factors talking to some county clerks for the ability to print all of that material actually on a ballot. Their ballots are designed to accommodate the current statutes. Section 56, number 3, 6. Says that not later than the fifth business day after the Legislative Assembly files the ballot with ballot title with the Secretary of State, that a petition shall name the Attorney General as the respondent. Currently, we have 10 days, business days, for this process to happen. And so normally what happens when people gather signatures and they use the referendum process is that they gather the signatures and the Secretary of State counts them. And then the Secretary of State, if that petition qualifies, the first 1,000 signatures or even a referendum, they take those and they send it over to the Attorney General, who drafts the first ballot title. And then there's a 14 calendar days, 10 business day window where people have the opportunity, the public has an opportunity to comment. And then that next piece of that process after there's public commentary is the Attorney General goes back up and says, okay, well, we'll make some of those changes or not based on that public comment. And then there's another 14-day window where the people have the right for the due process to go up to the Supreme Court. And then what happens after that is that if the Supreme Court agrees with the oral arguments and the petitioners who don't like the ballot title, the title is remanded back to the Attorney General for the purpose of making the additional changes. And then the title goes back to the Supreme Court, and if they find that the Attorney General still did not do his or her job, then the Supreme Court has the ballot title drafting authority. A 7-member, nonpartisan, elected Supreme Court. This section changes that, and it says there's only 5 days for that commentary. And in the Section 7, the modified ballot title is not subject to judicial review. So you're leaving one partisan Attorney General to be able to actually do this ballot titling process, because that final stamp will not come from the Supreme Court. Section 58.2 is that same process. Besides the ballot title, we're also looking to do that for some of the explanatory statement. Again, limiting public comment and process.
Representative Parrish, I just want to make sure you're working off the 10s, right?
I am trying to work off the 10s, and I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I just want to let you know that in the 11s, page 5, line 25, it says that certify the ballot title to the Secretary of State or refer the ballot. So it's not the same as the 10s. There's an or in there.
Okay, so walk me through how that changed, because, again, I didn't have time to look at that.
No, that's fine. The court shall modify the ballot title and certify the ballot title to the Secretary of State or refer the ballot title to the Attorney General for modification.
But does the question I have then, Madam Chair, is if the court refers back to the Attorney General and the Attorney General makes any changes, is the final judicial review at the Supreme Court, or does it stop as the modified ballot title in the dash 11?
Yes, it stops.
So that's the problem with this, because the current process is, no matter where it's at in the 8, the 10s or 11s, the current process allows that the final determination is not a partisan elected attorney general. It is a nonpartisan 7-member state Supreme Court.
Yeah, Representative Brayfield.
And Madam Chair, just for clarification for those in the audience, and because you haven't read the actual amendment we're considering, this component allows the Supreme Court to actually make that final determination. And so that 7 independent body that you like would actually be able to make that final call under the current amendment. So if they chose and they felt it was in the best interest of Oregonians, they could submit it to the Attorney General.
Or the Secretary of State.
So we leave it up to the nonpartisan body that you feel comfortable with to make that decision for what's best for Oregonians.
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, so are you saying then that should that process of kind of that volleyball back and forth of ballot title, that the current process of the state Supreme Court to overrule the Attorney General and write the ballot title and the yes statement and the no statement, are you saying that they actually still under the dash 11 are not the final stamp and say send it back to the AG, but they actually have the final drafting authority?
Yes.
They do. Thank you. That's one. I want to make sure that that is clear, and I will double check that with Elsie. Thank you. So I also have concerns about the fact that the legislature writes the ballot title. 3 years ago, this body tried that, and every media outlet in the state roundly panned us for taking away that process. This is when citizens decided to gather signatures because they did not agree with this body to give driver's cards to undocumented citizens who live in our state. They went out and they gathered signatures and they qualified for the ballot, and in a partisan process decided at the House side that there were people who wanted to take that right away and draft that ballot title. Now, I always tell my children, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And that bill died in the Senate, and the ballot titling went through the actual process as it's currently assigned. So to take 2 members of the majority party and 1 member of the minority party and from each chamber and say that we'll have partisans draft the ballot title without, again, having sort of this full public commentary process, I find that to be a problem. I appreciate that there apparently looks like there is going to be a fiscal in the bill. The dash 10s didn't. This election, as I understand it, is going to cost $3.32 million in a time when our general fund, we've heard all lots of times this session that we don't have money. So we couldn't fund a housing program. We didn't fund $3 million to a veteran's oral care. There's lots of things we'd like to fund. But an election outside of the regularly scheduled general election, when we already have 4 on our books, we run an election in March, we run an election in May, we run an election in September, and we run an election in November, I think that's a problem, and I don't think that's the wisest use of our taxpayer dollars. The last piece of this bill, of the amendment, and I'm assuming it's in the dash 11s too, is that the dash 10s have an emergency clause. The whole purpose of that emergency clause is when there's an actual emergency. I've had emergency clauses on bills because sometimes you want something to start for the next school year. That makes sense. But there's a reason that our revenue-raising bills don't have an emergency clause or the capability for us to do that. Because when the question is so big, and there are big questions that are happening right here in this building. Do we tax the smallest of our small businesses? Do we tax people's health care? Do we tax people's employment payroll taxes for transportation projects? That the people have a right to go back and say yes or no. And if they go through the process of gathering 59,000 signatures, valid signatures, in 90 days, I think that means the people want to be heard. So the Constitution does give the legislature the authority to set an election date. And statutorily, everything else falls to us or falls through the rules process. And I get that. But again, just because we can doesn't mean we should. So I'm going to ask that we do not move the amendments, that we stick with the base bill, because the base bill is needed to clean up elections, and move the base bill and not have any amendments.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Parrish? Representative Rayfield.
So whether you read the media or in the relationship that you have with Lindsey Burschauer, who is the individual that opened the PAC to potentially refer this, and there's one $10,000 donor in that PAC, which also has a relationship to you, my question is, you will be tasked as a part of this group, since you're leading the effort, to refer everything, specifically the was it HB 2391, are you going to refer the entire bill 2391, or are there specific portions of the bill that you are going to seek to change through referendum?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, at this point, that has not been decided by those of us who are interested in being petitioners for this, we certainly have a time window to make that decision.
Okay, and just follow up. So with that said, so in that bill, we shore up in general fund, and for the folks in this audience, general fund, a lot of this money is used for matching dollars, right? So we have general fund, and this draws down a lot of federal funds, which can fill, we're talking billions of dollars here, into our health care plan. So 2391 really helps us get up to about $600 million to fill a shortfall. That's a lot of money. If you only referred a portion of it, and, you know, I listened to your floor speech and a lot of the other floor speeches, and there was the MCO tax, the 1.5%, that is about $231 million of general fund. Again, I'm going to speak in terms of general fund dollars. If we were to go with your plan, and your plan would be to allow this to go to the November 2018 election, if we were to go with your plan, what ends up happening is we force an interesting decision for the Oregon Health Authority. If the Oregon Health Authority decides, okay, we're going to move forward all the way until November and just assume that the ballot measure is going to pass, and it does not pass, we are essentially two-thirds of the way through a biennium at that point. If we don't do anything and we don't do any contingency planning and it fails, we will put the state in a financial crisis. We will jeopardize health care for millions of people, and we're going to have to find a way to shore up, whether it's $231 million of general fund or $600 million of general fund, in less than 8 months. Now, also for the folks watching, this is very important. The current plan that we have right now, 2391, was a plan that was worked through with numerous stakeholders, numerous legislators. It was bipartisan, and it took us 4 months. So not only are we going to have very little time to react and govern responsibly if we were to wait that late. So what we have to do, if you are responsible in government, you would start now and you would say, all right, as soon as we get to and we find out that it is going to be referred, at that point we would ask the Oregon Health Authority, please start planning for when this doesn't pass. And that means we're going to have to start making cuts because we do not have the revenue. So my question to you is, have you thought this stuff out? And what is your plan B on how you are going to shore up this shortfall in a time when we're not even going to have a legislative session by the time that this is finally comes down?
Well, since that was not part of my testimony, but you've asked the question, Chair Williamson, Representative Rayfield, I'd like to ask you a question, if that's all right.
Can you
Representative Rayfield?
Can you address his question first?
Well, I mean, it is part of that, because I just heard responsible government. And maybe I just want to ask the question because I know the answer. Representative Rayfield, In fact, all the Democratic members of this committee voted for Senate Bill 1. That was the bill to abolish Cover Oregon. It resulted in a $400 million additional technology failure that this current OHA budget that we just voted out and with these bills are going to go and backfill more IT, which will put us close to $1 billion in healthcare IT projects, $300 million for Cover Oregon, $400 million for the Medicaid program. And you voted for that. And so should that be paid for on the backs of college students, small business owners, and nonprofits, and $25 million sucked out of the K-12 budget? We haven't even done the analysis yet on higher ed. I disagree with that premise. And so to answer your question, I also heard in your testimony, the question to me about stakeholders who agree with this. Well, guess what? All those stakeholders get something out of this. There's a, in Section 8 of 2391, we expressly, those who voted on it, expressly gave permission for insurance companies to pass the 1.5% tax through to the ratepayer. So that's a problem. I think people are going to have a problem with that. Those stakeholders write big campaign checks, Representative Rayfield. So I can appreciate that stakeholders who are going to financially benefit from a tax package that they can legally pass on to consumers had no problem with the bill. The Hospitals Association and their folks who are making large salaries that come out of our tax dollars. See, ultimately, I'm a capitalist. I believe in capitalism. I believe that if you finance your house and if you take out a mortgage or you go to the bank and you take out some debt and you build a company, go out and the government should get out of your way. But I hold companies and organizations that their business is relying specifically on our tax dollars, I think we need to hold them to a higher standard. There were some bills this session I would have looked to do that, to make all the CCOs go nonprofit. I think that was an absolute mistake in the 2011 legislation, and I'll own that I was a freshman and probably missed that when I voted yes to create CCOs. Because you see, Representative Rayfield, I grew up in the Medicaid system. I remember when the Medicaid piece of paper, if they even called it that in the 80s and early 90s, once a month it showed up at your door. And you had health care when it showed up at your door. And the agency wasn't growing broke because, you know, if you moved, you had to go back and check in with the welfare office. That's what we called it back then when I was a kid. And so I voted for the bill to create CCOs. I supported the idea of an expansion, which would probably put me different than some Republicans, because I ultimately believe, and I said it today earlier on the floor when we were talking about House Bill, you know, the 3391 bill, as we're driving up health care costs, session after session after session, driving up health care costs. I think we have the money. And, your crisis might not be what other people perceive as a crisis. We walked into this session with $1.5 billion of new revenue. And then we're choosing to spend it on solar panels for swimming pools for rich people, tax credits in the transportation package for people who can afford to buy a Tesla. There are lots of ways we can make spending priorities. And so let me just get to what the 3467 Representative Hayden's bill does. It says, we'll take the fully funded number for the first year and we'll fund Medicaid. At the number that is the number that we don't even know what the real redetermination number is, because, of course, the agency hasn't done their work. 85,000 people who may or may not actually still qualify. We certainly know some of them will fall off the rolls, and that will readjust the number of that people need to have. And there were some shared, you've seen the document, because I know he gave it to you. I created a document. I'd happily put it up on OLIS between the two packages of some shared ideas of, we agree with the intergovernmental transfer piece between OHSU and the state. And for those in the room who don't understand how this Medicaid funding works, it's sort of some shenanigans. Let's just be honest. So the hospital says, hey, state of Oregon, under this assessment, we'll give you some money. Wink, wink, nod, nod. And we collect it from them, or however that works. And then we say, hey, Uncle Sam, we have this money. And then we'll get that money from Uncle Sam, and we get back to the hospitals. So that's what the current bill does, or the current law does. But under 2391, there's also a true tax to hospitals. So what does that mean? It means that when Sally goes to the hospital because she has a broken arm, and let's say it's $100 to fix her arm, and the insurance pays 80% and Sally's co-pays 20, then she owes $20. Then what you do is you say, okay, well, the hospitals have to pay that tax somehow, so they ratchet up the price of Sally's broken arm. So her insurance still pays 80%, she pays 20. Now that copay is $30. How is taxing other people's health care making health care more affordable? I mean, seriously. I had a bill, so Representative Hayden, I'll let you look at the notes and do his math, but, I trust a bill drafted by a doctor who has a dentist who has served his life serving the Medicaid population versus others in this building who might have drafted some of this with the input of internal stakeholders. But let me tell you about two other bills. I had a bill to move public employees into the exchange. We know that the cost of the gold plan in the exchange is almost $11,000. We know we're paying $17,000. Take $6,000, times it by all our public employees. There's your savings for the Medicaid. I didn't just bring that bill. I said, well, let's try it a different way. Let's put all the public employees into CCOs. Under House Bill 3650, which created the CCOs, Section 13 says once we stand up CCOs for the Medicaid population, we will look at putting public employees in there. And what does that solve? It solves things like sort of the double coverage for, you know, married spouses, because if you're two soldiers in the Army, you just get TRICARE. You just get one plan. Department of Revenue says that double coverage is costing the state of Oregon, at least in tax year 14, with the most recent numbers, $400 million. So understand, Representative Rayfield, I am willing to work on ways to fund health care. I think there's ways to do it, and I'd be happy to keep digging through the budget with you to pull out things that I think that we're not spending money on correctly in order to pay for those folks. We were on food stamps till the last kid turned 18. I am grateful for that. You will never see me vote against a hunger bill. I believe people should have health care. I don't think you should tax health care, housing, or food.
Amen.
If healthcare really is a human right, then let's have that conversation. But you know what? I also believe that if there's a bucket of dollars called taxpayer-funded healthcare, it should all be in one bucket. You shouldn't get something special because it's an employment benefit versus something that we can provide if it's something for somebody in need, and it's all paid with tax dollars. So there are ways to get there, and I'm confident that when voters voted us annual sessions, let's assume for a minute we had a November general. Let's assume for a minute that they gathered the signatures. We were successful in gathering signatures to refer 2391, since that's what we've made this bill about, this amendment about. Then what would happen if that happened? Well, we could come back in February, Representative Rayfield, with all of these different ideas. We could work them through the session, in the February session, and then we could slap an emergency clause out, which I would support, as long as you're not taxing people's health care to pay for it. In fact, House Bill 3467 did have a moderate bump in the cigarette tax, a completely new e-vaping tax, which would be dedicated to mental health. Republicans are chief sponsored on that. We didn't say we wouldn't raise some taxes to pay for health care. What we said is we're not willing to tax other people's health care to do it. There's a difference. So I feel very confident between now and the February session, if we had no special election, we would find a solution that could work.
Vice Chair Rayfield.
Yeah. So I appreciate that long diatribe. As we go through the process, unfortunately, you didn't answer the question, and even yourself on the House floor noted that these numbers don't add up. And I would urge you, when you propose solutions, if you go to legislative fiscal, I'm having a really tough time that when your own self-admissions on the floor that your plan would underfund the Medicaid program and jeopardize, quite frankly, other things like K-12, other higher ed, because you aren't fully funding the Oregon Health Plan. I find that just very frustrating. But specifically, what I want to ask you about is in the second part is really we have the DCBS, okay? And there's one of the things for folks is in this room is that when you send something to a referral in November of 2018, almost a year and a half later, that bill is completely stayed. And one of the key components of 2391 is a program that will stabilize the individual market rates for insurance. And keep in mind that there are a lot of vulnerable people that do not have money to be able to afford health insurance premiums, but cannot purchase them on the market and receive federal subsidies that allow them to get that health care. What we've been finding over the last 2 years is that this market is becoming destabilized. We've had to work with Moda to keep them in the market. And just yesterday in the newspaper, you saw that Regents is even going to pull out of some of these individual markets. The underlying bill creates creates a program to help reduce premiums by up to 4.9% for these folks. If we send a referendum to November, this program is stalled. If we do it in January and it does not pass, then we're able to react nimbly and quickly and govern to give people the relief that they need. Nor did your plan on the floor account for how you're going to do this. So if we refer this and delay this, what type of solutions do you have to make sure that we give relief to all of these folks that are going to have their premiums reduced by the underlying plan?
Well, thank you again. Great questions. So I just heard you talk about the need to stabilize the individual marketplace, and yet we just passed a bill on the floor today that jacks up the price of insurance as Regents is pulling out of the market, including in my district where one of my constituents just got notified that he's going to lose his health care. Mm-hmm. We destabilized the exchange. You were not here in 2013 to take the vote on House Bill 2128, but that was a bill that would have put all of OEB into the Oregon Health Exchange. It would have been about 150,000 lives. The goal for when we passed Senate Bill 99 was that by the end of the year 2015, the exchange needed to have 281,000 lives in it to work. It currently has 135,000 lives, and only 30% of those people don't get any kind of subsidy from the ACA at all. So they're paying full freight. So every time we jack up the price of health care through insurance, and understand under the federal law, there's also going to be a tax in 2018 that comes that is part of the current ACA, not anything Republicans are doing with their shenanigans in Congress, that's going to be a 3% tax. So we're taxing health care to pay for other people's health care. And, you know, and the exchange is currently completely destabilized. And I believe we destabilized that when Democrats undid a deal in this building to put teachers in the exchange. Had we put those teachers in the exchange, to your point about pulling out money for K-12, it would have saved about $300 million a school year. So we lost school year 15, school year 16, school year 17, school year 18. That's about $1.2 billion. And House Bill 2391 actually taxes the large group market, Representative. And if you're worried about education, well, that takes about $25 million out of the K-12 budget. So we purposefully put forward a plan that gets us 80% funded on the current enrollees in Medicaid, understanding that there is a redetermination that's going to happen on August 31st, that there will be an audit that will make additional recommendations. There was a policy piece that said simply just asking the OHA to do monthly residency reconciliations. So what that means is you pull down your list of who's in the Oregon Health Authority in our Medicaid, and you match it up to the National Change of Address List, where people have self-reported that they no longer live in our state. Because what happens now, according to the Oregon Health Authority, is that Sally signs up for the OHA and she's a single mom with three kids. That payment roughly works out to be about $1,600 a month to her CCO. We pay the CCOs once a month. Sally moves out in month three. CCOs don't know it. The state of Oregon doesn't know it because Sally doesn't actually have to tell us that she's gone. So the CCO keeps collecting for family that's not even a resident anymore. And we've overpaid them. There are some simple things that we can do that actually get us to a better number. And here's my commitment. If we passed a bill that wasn't 100% complete, and then we needed to look at some tax revenue in to pay for that in February, after all of the data protocols are cleaned up, I'd vote for that bill. That's my commitment right here. And people might not like what my words are, but I think they understand at least that when I say things, I'm not playing around and that my word is my bond that way. So I'm willing to get there. But I also think we need to look at on the public side. It is unconscionable to me that we pay $17,000 a month for a public employee while we, at the beginning of the session, we're contemplating kicking 350,000 lives off Medicaid if we couldn't solve this budget. That was the original headline in the paper. So in the expansion market. So I'm, you know, to your point, what happens and we don't have a session and we don't know? Well, I'll tell you what. Elections calendar says if we have a January election on 2018 on January 23rd and ballots are mailed and voters' pamphlet statements go out and everyone's given up their Christmas holiday, that they don't actually certify that election for 20 days. We will already be halfway through the February session, Representative Rayfield, before that election is certified. So not having an election doesn't necessarily change the outcome. You could have something that's really close and contested, and we wouldn't know the outcome of that election until we're already back. And constitutionally, we can tap in for five more days and extend this session. We have a right to do that. Governor can call us back into a special session. Legislature can call us back into a special session. We're paid, whether we're here or not, by the people of this state. So And I appreciate that calling this body back in on holidays or work days or things cost money, but they cost a lot less money than running a special set election. I believe, if I recall, a couple years ago, maybe Representative McClain remembers, it's maybe $35,000, $50,000 a day to be here a day. So for the legislature versus $3.32 million for an election, I think we have lots of options. And you and I are just going to have a difference of opinion, Representative Rayfield. That's fine.
Additional question.
Can I, Representative Parrish, you said $17,000 a month for a public employee. You meant a year.
A year.
$17,000 a year is what the state of Oregon spends on public employee. The other thing I want to say is Representative Hayden gave me this, and he and Representative Rayfield had a disagreement on the numbers. And I believe when Representative Rayfield, in his closing, had said, hey, this information isn't accurate, and encouraged, you know, Representative Hayden to check on it, he did check on it. I may not be the smartest guy when it comes to the health care numbers. That's not my committee. But Representative Hayden did give me some information, said he did check on him. He was right, and he isn't here, but I wish he was, because I think he would actually be able to have a discourse with you publicly. But I just want to encourage you.
Is that an OLIS?
Yes, it is.
Oh, is this? Okay, so I just encourage that I think to the extent that Representative Hayden was questioned on his numbers, I know he has validated a lot of what he said. So
okay.
You healthcare smart guys, go talk about that. I just wanted to flag it on that.
Yes,
but other than that, Representative Parrish, I didn't want to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure that her month versus year was correct.
Question?
Well, I've just been hearing a lot about how this potential amendment's going to suppress voters, you know, this special election, and I was just trying to figure out, where that came from. I saw a few things about that, and we have vote by mail, and mm-hmm. you know, we also have, everyone gets their ballot, and you know, everyone has equal access to send their ballot in or not, and so I've just kind of wondering what's preventing voters from casting their ballots in a January election.
Well, thank you. That's a great question, Representative Hulvey, Chair Williamson. Well, a couple things. It looks like that's language that's still in on page 4 of the dash 11. Not later than the 10th day before the election, the Secretary of State shall cause the voter's pamphlet to be mailed. But we didn't change the ballot date. So ballots actually have to go out like the 18th or 19th day. I can't recall off the top. So theoretically, you get your ballot before you get your voter's pamphlet under this amendment. I think that's a form of suppression when people don't have the full information to vote. My husband was deployed during the special election in 2010. He was in Iraq, and we had a special election. And it was, you know, tough to make sure that he got a ballot. So I can tell you right now, when you've got people who are overseas and the mail grinds to a halt, and for Christmas, when people are sending packages and letters to their loved ones overseas, I think it disenfranchises a small group of folks. We also know that just generally special elections have really low turnout. People have busy lives. I actually missed voting in a few elections when my husband was deployed because I was still sort of just raising 3 kids by myself for that year. And so some of the 2009 elections, I just didn't get a chance to cast my ballot because life got in the way. And so you're talking about people.
But that would be your choice.
It would be my choice. That's a true statement.
You can't really say that's voter's expression.
You have
the choice.
Thank you, Representative. But we also understand that in a state where vote by mail ballots get lost, we know that if you want to go fix your ballot, and let's talk about rural Oregon, because I used to live in Southern Oregon. It's the county seat for Jackson County in Medford. And if you are somebody who is inactivated under our current laws, and you want to, ballots are out and you're in an active status and you thought you were going to get a ballot, you're a senior and you're maybe homebound, you have to actually go to the county seat to get your ballot because we don't have a polling place. I'll just put this in the context of my own family member. My older sister's ex-boyfriend, who's the father of my two wonderful nephews, had a really massive stroke. He lives in West Lynn, And but he can still vote, but he can't drive, has no driver's license. I had to go up with him three times to the Clackamas County elections in the November 16 election because of our signature laws and the hurdles that it takes to vote by mail. I like vote by mail. I understand it is very convenient. We've also heard, you know, we should put a stamp on those ballots. But for people who are elderly, homebound, seniors, if your ballot is wrong, you have to get to the county seat. In a county that doesn't have transit, that's a problem. In a place where you don't have a ride to go fix your ballot, that's a problem. It's just a quirk. And if you've been inactivated and you thought you were going to get a ballot through no fault of your own and the elections come and you don't actually know that you were not getting a ballot regularly mailed to you, you might just miss an election. So I think that because of the way we have inactive voters and we've never passed any of my bills to try to fix those or anybody else's bills to fix inactive voting status in this state. And how do you become inactive? Maybe you didn't respond to your county clerk. Maybe you missed a federal election or two and suddenly you're inactivated. The first time I learned about inactive voters was when I had a constituent put a dollar in the jar at the Rotary right after a May election and scream at me because he didn't understand that the election had come and gone and he had been inactivated. So yes, the onus is on people to vote, and if the onus is on people to vote, maybe we shouldn't pay for stamps on ballots. But the point is that in a special election, winter, inclement weather, all of those things could pose a challenge to people voting in an election that is not normally scheduled and that people don't understand a January election as a special election, not on our regular calendar
year.
Yes,
a follow-up. I do want
Decide that's not voter suppression, Representative Volvey, but again, we can disagree.
I disagree with that. I think that you know, a special election is important if it appears that if we wait till November, we're going to 400,000 people are going to lose their Medicaid and children insurance if we wait that long. And, you know, voter suppression, I mean, the Constitution lays out for us to do special elections when circumstances kind of dictate the importance of doing that. And the idea that it's a mail-in ballot and there's problems with that is voter suppression. I mean, that would occur in any election that we have. So those hypotheticals that you present don't convince me that there's any voter suppression in a special election. It's really offensive to think that we're following the Constitution and we're following the laws for what we think is best for Oregonians, and you want to call it voter suppression. You know, I just really find that offensive.
Well, Chair Williamson, Representative Holvey, I would think that if 59,000 people decide to go gather signatures under the very, you know, first part of the Constitution, which says the regularly scheduled general election, which is their expectation, not that the legislature is going to come in here and kind of fiddle with the process, even though we can, again, going back to just because we can, should. I just think we have a difference of opinion on that.
Okay, we're going to have to move on because all but one of us have to be in a different committee in 7 minutes. So, Representative Smith Warner.
Well, thank you. I was just struck, honestly, listening to the two, you know, I'm interested in healthcare. I'm not on that committee. I haven't done that. But listening to the two of you talk back and forth about different bills that have passed and ideas you've had that haven't been passed, and a legislative proposal that was passed, and it felt very much like you were saying, well, and I had all these ideas and they didn't get passed, and the way that this was passed, I disagree with, and so I am going to get involved in filing an initiative to overturn it because you didn't like that. That does not feel to me what the referendum process is for. It's not, well, I was on the losing end of this vote as a legislator, and my ideas didn't get passed, and so I'm now gonna file to get that overturned. That doesn't feel like what the referendum process is for. Not when you are on the losing side of an election.
Chair Williamson, Representative
Hold on, hold on.
I just want to ask a follow-up. As you ask that, I'm curious because I know that SEIU threatened a referendum on the transportation package. How do you distinguish the SEIU threat on that in what Representative Parrish has done?
Well, I would argue that she is a legislator who has the ability to promote and vote for and vote against bills, and she has said a number of her bills that haven't gotten passed and ones that
well, they haven't had hearings,
that
so let's start there.
Okay.
Hold everybody.
That she didn't like, and, you know,
And SEIU has no voice in this building?
Okay. All right. We're going to.
They're not legislators.
So, Representative Smith Warner, okay. I'll simply answer the question.
Please
Before
do.
I'm a legislator, I'm still a citizen of the state. Okay. I'm still a taxpayer of this state. And I have those rights under the Constitution.
Okay. We're going to keep this civil. Representative Rayfield, and we can have civil discourse in this building, please.
So, just a couple things. I think one of the things that I've been struggling with is you moonlight as a political consultant. In 2016, you earned you're the company. If you go to the Secretary of State's website, you own a company.
Please.
You own a company Please. Called PIP Consulting or a part of PIP Communications. Sorry, I apologize. Mm-hmm. And you earned over $300,000 or grossed, not earned, but you grossed over $300,000 from the Dennis Richardson campaign. You worked on Tootie Smith's campaign. Jody Bailey's campaign, Matt Geiger's campaign.
Where are we going with
Cal
this?
Cody, I'll get there. The person who filed this was, who the PAC is also Bershauer. Bershauer also profited from all of those same campaigns. So when you come here today, the real question that I want to ask you is, are you coming here today as a consultant or are you here as a legislator, and do you intend to profit off of this referendum?
So Representative Rayfield, Chair Williamson, since you've opened that door, happy to have that conversation.
Needs that.
No, let's start there. I was paid $2,500 a month to help run the campaign of Secretary Richardson. I probably put in 80 hours a week. So it was like for gas money and things like that, because ultimately I gave up my business to help him do that. I gave up some similar to Representative Williamson, who stopped her private law practice and now gets paid by Future PAC to do campaigning, except mine's forward-facing an ADP, and hers is in Orstar, and hers is hidden behind an ADP veil that shows up in Future PAC. I'm willing to put my stuff out on the record. There's a little bit of a difference. And then if we really want to start talking about who gets paid what, well, you know, Representative Nose works for the Nurses Association. More than $100,000 of his PAC has come from the Nurses Association, his employer. Has Representative Nose ever voted no against anything the Nurses Association wanted? I mean, do we really want to go here? Because
you're
collectively
being paid this session by Dennis Richardson.
Okay, we're gonna
answering because collectively between the five Democrats on here, unions stopped some bills because they didn't want to change their health care, and special interests on the other side got carved out in the other one. Collectively, you all have taken nearly $1 million, and if you'd like, I'll put all of that on OLIS. So, you know what?
It's public record.
We can have that conversation. So, maybe we should pay partisan majority leaders out of partisan PACs. Maybe we should do some campaign finance, and I'd be happy to have that conversation, too. But seriously, Representative Rayfield, your question's out of line, but, you know, I guess we'll see what shows up.
In profited from your campaigns.
Okay,
in the past.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, we're done with that.
Close the work session.
Is anybody else?
We'll come back to it. Okay.
All right.
Because, of course, all that's germane to the dash 10 and 11.
I'm going to close the work session. We're going to all take it down a notch. Okay.
It's not a public hearing.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to go back to Senate Bill 43 for a second.
Am I excused?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank
Have a
you.
Great 4th of July, everyone.
Mm-hmm. We don't clap during hearings. We don't. Okay. What are we doing now?
We're going to work session on Senate Bill.
Okay. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 43A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 43A was heard on June 15th. Senate Bill 43A revises, clarifies circumstances when individuals, including public officials, elected public officials, must register as lobbyists with Oregon Government Ethics Commission.
Okay.
It requires public official who has position with public body and whose written job description includes lobbying, spends accurate aggregate amount of more than 24 hours or $100 lobbying legislative or executive officials to register with the Government Ethics Commission. It specifies specifically exempts from registration requirements people who meet with legislator in personal capacity. It removes sunset on lobbyist exemption on reporting to Oregon Government Ethics Commission money spent on lobbying other registered lobbyists. You have an A2 amendment. The A2 amendment adds to the bill, requires lobbyist statements filed with Oregon Government Ethics Commission to identify each topic and each measure lobbied, whether for or against, and whether amendments were sought. Excludes measures of interest that lobbyists did not attempt to influence. Requires accuracy on date filing. provides for modification between filing dates. It permits modification without penalty so long as no complaint is received by the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Prohibits Oregon Government Ethics Commission from imposing fine for filing inaccurate information the first time or if the Ethics Commission determines it was a mistake. Makes new requirements for lobbyist statements operative April 1st, 2018. Directs the Oregon Government Ethics Commission to make additional information available in searchable online format operative August 1, 2020. Allows statements filed between April 1st of 2018 and April 1st of 2020 to be included as attachment to lobbying statement. And it establishes the Advisory Committee on Lobbying Transparency to be staffed by Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Madam Chairman of the Committee, you do have a fiscal statement on the A2, and you have a no revenue impact statement on the A2.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 43A.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 43A. Is there any discussion? Vice Chair McLean.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I pose the amendment. I'm trying to get my arms around it, but one thing I do see is the Advisory Committee on Lobbying Transparency, two members appointed by the Speaker of the House, two members appointed by the Senate, the President. That excludes minority parties from having a say. And when you're dealing with lobbying and transparency, I think that's just completely unacceptable. If you want to set up a formula to have no buy-in by the minority members of the legislature, this is the way to do it. I also looked at, it just seems that this goes on and on and on, and I just wonder, I don't oppose the Dash A2. Gosh, I hope I'm on the right bill. I'm on the right bill. Okay.
I could eliminate,
because I was on a roll.
I hope you are too.
Representative McLean?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Vice Chair Rayfield.
Sorry, but before we go for the, I should have done a little better job on the communication before this came to the committee. Earlier in the session, we passed the lobby disclosure bill that would require lobbyists to report which bills that they're lobbying on, which then creates a website so that the public can see what's going on. That's what this bill is. That bill had been gut and stuffed in the Senate, and so we are putting that original bill that we all voted for in this committee. That's what that Dash A2 is. And so that the advisory committee is actually intended to have one lobbyist, two legislative members, so that way they can develop a website so that it can be, so that the public can view it. The reason I put the two members on there was because I wanted people who are end users so that, like, are actually looking at, this is what I would want to see as a member of the public to kind of go through this. And then I wanted to make sure we had the lobby also in part of that process, because they're going to, you, all of us will be using the back end as we type in our SEI forms. So that's why that committee was in there. So it's the exact same bill. So,
okay. Yeah. All right. That's very helpful. Then I'll tell you what, I'll be a no now, and then you and I can do some follow-up questions. My assumption is that if the speaker's going to appoint two members, it'll be one from the minority party and one from the majority party.
I would hope so.
Okay, that's what. All right, then I'm sure she will, but I'll just be a no now, and then we'll follow up by the
I floor. Just wanted to make sure you knew what right. would happen process-wise.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, any further discussion? Sam, can you call the roll, please?
Representative
Brett? Excused.
Representative Heck?
Excused.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
President Kemmer?
Excused.
Yes.
President
Nose? Yes. President
Sephorner?
Aye. Vice Chair McClain?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Williamson?
Yes. Motion passes. Carrier will be. Oh, sorry. That's just the amendment. I keep doing that. Sorry. Go ahead.
Madam Chair.
If you want, you could just note that I'm opposed and.
Move on. Okay.
Yeah, and okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 43 to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved Senate Bill 43A to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Objection, Vice Chair McLean, Barreto, Hack, Kenemer are excused. Thank you. Motion passes. Carrier will be Representative Rayfield. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 43A. And then we'll open the work session on 229A.
Madam Chair, I move the A11 amendments to Senate Bill 229A.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the A11 amendments to Senate Bill 229A. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Vice Chair McLean.
Madam Chair, Representative Cedric Hayden texted me. You know, as you know, he was previously scheduled out today, so otherwise he would be here. But he did say that he would request that the -11 be held off until a hearing on the health care bill 3467. I just put that out there on behalf of Representative Hayden. I'll be a no on the amendment for a series of reasons. I believe the members who couldn't be here today, I don't know if the folks know this, but Representative Barreto's son, his wedding is today, it's been planned, and Representative Hack is at the wedding. Representative Kinnemer had a another scheduled event. So they aren't shirking their duties, but you know, he's the father of the groom, so
sure.
You should probably be there. Yeah. All right, and just for the committee, the next motion will be to send this to Ways and Means, so it is not going to the floor today. It will be in yet another set of hearings. So any further discussion?
On the A11s.
On the A11 amendment to 229A. Objections?
Just me.
Vice Chair McLean, the others are all excused. Motion passes. Jeez.
And Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 229A with a due pass as amended recommendation that the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved Senate Bill 229A with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means. Any discussion?
I'll be objecting for the reasons. I do want to say, because this is obviously a lot of folks are very concerned, this does have a fiscal, it's going to have a financial impact on the state. So sending it to Ways and Means to be reviewed in the budget is a proper way in which you deal with a bill that has a financial impact. So there is there's nothing improper about that. However, I've opposed the amendment. I'm going to oppose it going to Ways and Means for the same reasons. I'm on the Ways and Means Committee, so I second crack at that there. I just think that obviously we've got problems and we should not be moving it until the full review, like Representative Hayden has requested, is be done. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you for explaining the process for those who are following this bill. Any further discussion? Any objections? Vice Chair McLean, other members are excused. Motion passes. We're going to close that work session.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, while we do not have a meeting scheduled yet, please anticipate a meeting on Monday.
Ah.
Excellent.
Morning or afternoon?
Well, hold on.
Who knows?
That were adjourned.
Who knows?
That were adjourned.
Morning or afternoon?
Hold on.